Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today on this Easter Sunday, we will look at Christianity in America, that at first glance appears to be dominated by mercantile interests and allied with political conservatism. However, we will explore the other side of religion, faith as a force for social activism and economic justice, and begin with James Carroll, a former priest who became a civil rights worker and anti-war activist, and a best-selling author who received the first Thomas Merton Award. Then Sister Ann Kendrick joins us. She co-founded the Office for Farm Worker Ministry to address the hardships confronting migrant workers, migrant laborers in Central Florida. We'll discuss how her religious faith moved her to serve the least among us. Then finally, for all those atheists and agnostics who have not tuned out by now, we'll be joined by veteran prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi, who will examine the evidence of the divinity of Jesus Christ and put the very existence of God on trial, as he has done in his new book, Divinity of Doubt, The God Question. I'd also like to invite you all to a free public forum at the Hammer Museum in Westwood this Tuesday night, April the 26th at 7 p.m. We'll be discussing the new global financial elite, and I'll be joined by one of the best finance journalists, Felix Salmon, who will examine how the too big to fail banks are driving the disparity of wealth in our country while creating a new global elite abroad. You can check out the notice in the latest LA Weekly's Go LA section for Tuesday. The event is free and open to the public, and I hope you can make it next Tuesday, April the 26th at 7 p.m. at the Hammer Forum. Let's now begin examining Christianity in America. I'm joined by James Carroll, who's the author of Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the ancient city that ignited the modern world. He's a distinguished scholar in residence at Suffolk University and a former priest who became a civil rights worker and an anti-war activist and a community organizer in Washington and in New York. James Carroll served as a Catholic chaplain at Boston University from 1969 to 1974 and then left the priesthood to become a writer. He was named best columnist by the Catholic Press Association and received the first Thomas Merton Award. His books include House of War, The Pentagon and the Disastrous Rise of American Power, An American Requiem, God, My Father, and the War That Came Between Us, and Practicing Catholic. His New York Times bestseller, Constantine's Sword, provided the basis for an award-winning documentary. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Carroll.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be here.
And in terms of the state of religion this country, I guess in many ways the Catholic Church serves as a metaphor for these two forces, the one that seems to be dominating the discourse, and the kind of insurgent force that is trying to actually do what the Bible invokes and what the prophet Jesus, the example that he set. And I suppose within the Catholic Church, you can argue that that civil war still continues. And I notice here that Pope Benedict will preside over the beatification of his predecessor shortly after the celebrations in London of this royal wedding. However, Pope Benedict remained silent. Pope Benedict's predecessor, John Paul, remained silent about and shielded pedophiles, and of course Pope Pius XII remained silent about the Holocaust. So at the same time, Dorothy Day hasn't been beatified. So give me a sense of where that civil war, whether it still continues within the Church.
Well, it's you're right in a way to use this analogy of an intense internal conflict that's very vivid in the Roman Catholic Church, as a kind of broader image of the stresses within Christianity and, you could say, within religion itself. The question to me is whether belief will be rational, critical, and self-critical, subject to the standards and tests of history and science, or whether belief going forward will be superstitious, contemptuous of the rational, fundamentalist, hostile to the great leaps in the human imagination that have been made in the modern and postmodern periods. Is religion doomed to fundamentalism, or can it be critical and rational? That's the question. And within the Roman Catholic tradition, which has been down through the centuries, for all the questions one might raise about it, it has been down through the centuries, a profoundly unfundamentalist tradition. The great thinkers of the Middle Ages and early modernity came from Roman Catholicism right up until the Reformation period. And Thomas Aquinas, for example, building on the work of St. Augustine at the end of the ancient era, the tradition of Catholic theology has insisted on the rationality of faith, the fact that faith is always subject to critical reason. That's at issue now. The papacy of John Paul II, followed by the papacy of Benedict XVI, have both emphasized the rational elements of religion, but in truth they've also both been profoundly fundamentalist. Catholic fundamentalism has taken hold of the Catholic imagination. You see that in the ahistorical way in which Scripture is used, for example, to reject the ordination of women to the priesthood, as if the fact that Jesus had no women among the 12 apostles is in any way a defining fact or event for doctrine. It simply isn't. It's fundamentalist to argue that.
Well, interesting enough, most of our focus has been on fundamentalists capturing the Protestant churches, particularly the television preachers, and the extent to which the Republican Party has been taken over, or at least heavily influenced by the so-called religious right. And, of course, we're aware of the extent to which Islam has been captured by fundamentalism due to the enormous petrodollar influence of the Saudi Wahhabi Hanif Ali sect. So it is, you're among the few people, James Carroll, who make that argument.
Well, in the Catholic tradition, we're not fundamentalist focused on the Bible, which is the way in which Protestant fundamentalism shows itself. No, Catholic fundamentalism doesn't insist on the primacy of the biblical word. It insists on the primacy of the hierarchy's word. Papal authority, emphasized to an extreme, is the heart and soul of Catholic fundamentalism, which is, of course, why we get this, what you could almost call worship of the papacy itself, papalolatry, a kind of idolatry of the papacy, which is a modern phenomenon. This is not traditional Catholicism. It begins in the 19th century with the anti-modern papacy of Pope Pius IX. The reason the Catholic Church has such trouble reckoning with Pope Pius XII's failures to oppose the Holocaust are that failure in itself calls into question the absolute moral authority of the papacy. So Benedict's elevation of Pope John Paul II is in part a tribute to an extraordinary figure, a man who really deserves to be admired and honored. But it's also a lifting up of the papacy itself. And Benedict has something of his own at stake in doing that. The Church is desperately trying to shore up the authority of the Catholic hierarchy. It's at the bottom of the problem the Church has had with the pedophilia scandal. A small minority of Catholic priests have been guilty of abusing children. The vast majority, one could almost say 100% of Catholic bishops, cardinals, and popes now, have protected the priests instead of the children. Why is that? Because they're protecting the Catholic structure of authority. That's what I mean by Catholic fundamentalism. And I would say, by the way, that that's why the Second Vatican Council, which calls into question the absolute claims for Catholic hierarchical authority, insisting on collegiality and the empowerment of lay people. That's why the Second Vatican Council was downplayed by Pope John Paul II and resisted to this day by Pope Benedict.
Again, I'm speaking with James Carroll, author of Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the Ancient City That Ignited the Modern World. So in terms of the battle over those that toil in the fields of our Lord and those that that are in the hallowed halls of the Vatican, in living in that kind of world of doctrine, as opposed to out there ministering to the poor and the needy. Where does that stand? Because the Pope that's about to be beatified was close to the ultra-Orthodox head of the Legion of Christ and Opus Dei, and arguably they were the kind of the vanguard, if you will, in the war against the Jesuits and other progressive forces within the Catholic Church.
Well, you know, I was just referring to the Catholic Church's problems with its hierarchy. The thing to remember, of course, is that the Catholic Church is the people. There are more than a billion Catholics across the globe. The Catholic Church is the largest NGO in the world. It does the tremendous works of good, the so-called corporal works of mercy, all over the place without strings attached. You have mentioned Dorothy Day as an emblem of that tradition in the church, but there are literally millions of unnamed Catholics devoted to the works of social justice and simple charity, and they draw sustenance from this tradition. They are true Catholics, and they are overwhelmingly people who understand the church properly tilts toward the poor, toward the dispossessed, toward those who have nothing. And it's a small minority of Catholics who still align themselves vigorously with power, with the capitalist owners, with those who benefit from the free market economy. And, of course, right-wing Catholic groups like Opus Dei are central to that conservative commitment of the church. But that is far from representative of the vast population of Catholics, most of whom, by the way, live in the South and are themselves desperately poor people. And they draw sustenance and the power to resist their situations from their faith.
James Carroll, you mentioned earlier the rise of superstition and ignorance. And I would think that you could make that case that that's not entirely in the province of religion. That is also in the province of politics. I mean, we have Donald Trump running for president, or at least appearing to do so, on this birther issue. And apparently half of the Republican Party that was recently polled by a Republican strategist believe that Obama is a Kenyan interloper.
The popular rise of what you might call unscientific and uncritical thinking, of which those are two powerful examples, is perhaps the single largest threat to the future of the human species. Because what are we talking about? The capacity of human beings to deny the science, for example, of climate change, is one clear example. The capacity of human beings to deny what science tells us about the dangers of nuclear weapons and nuclear power is another example. Is the human species going to go forward thinking critically about its situation, taking advantage of the genius insights of science, which is a modern phenomenon, thank God for science, and are religious people going to be allies of critical, historically minded scientific appreciation, or are religious people going to be the enemies of it? That's what makes the religious argument so important. So wherever religion invites believers to be irrational and uncritical, watch out, because those habits of mind now are dangerous for the human future.
Well, I can see, though, that in many ways they're more seductive, at least easier. It's easier to believe and in a dogma as opposed to the pursuit of inquiry and critical thinking. That requires patience and sometimes pain.
Well, also ambiguity, doubt, anxiety. It's living without absolutes and living without certitude, which is not, and no human being finds it easy to do that. And we all have our zones of superstition, I suspect. But what we owe it to each other, what we owe to each other is, especially in public discourse, is to submit what we say and how we behave to the tests of experience. That's the scientific idea, isn't it? That experience can be tested and ideas can be tested. And when the test shows them to be false, they can be left behind. It's crucial that we take advantage of the scientific method, if you will, in all aspects of life, that we learn from experience. Going forward, it's the only way to be hopeful that human beings are the creatures who do learn from experience. But that means we don't live in denial, and we don't live by kidding ourselves about the situation that we face.
So perhaps in this country where we have an unhealthy mix of religion and politics, and in spite of the separation of the war, separation between church and state, as I mentioned earlier, there's a tremendous fundamentalist influence in the Republican Party and the so-called Christian right, and many issues, including just in the budget now, where it's been in many ways hijacked by the abortion issue. We've had flag burning, prayer in school, and all of these extraneous things have in many ways distracted our political discourse. And it seems that maybe the church and state rigidity may be in part contributing to this. It would seem to me that it would be so much healthier to teach comparative religion in schools, for example, as opposed to having that wall, because the very things that you're talking about, I think if people were able to explore religion in its broadest context as opposed to its narrowest dogma, we would have a much healthier society where there would be less friction between the religious and the secular.
Well, it's true, and I'm, as a religious person myself, sensitive to the ways in which secular discourse is almost by definition discriminating in its attitudes toward religion. So when behavior is bad, it's readily labeled religious, but when it's good, it's labeled something else. Well, it's true we have fundamentalist trends in public life in America today, but we had religious trends in public life in America, for example, during the great civil rights movement, when Christian religion in particular, but not only Christian, was publicly invoked as a moral force. Figures like Dr. King, I'm thinking of naturally. But not only that, right now we're witnessing in the Arab world a profound revolution of democratic liberalism. The outcome of these revolutions aren't established yet, and it could go badly. But so far, there's reason to be very hopeful about these revolutions. And one of the things to understand about them is that they do come hand in glove out of a kind of religious impulse that's common among many Muslims. It's no accident that dictators have been challenged and overthrown even on weekends in these Arab revolutions over the last 3 months, following Friday prayers and following great rallies where people have experienced the dignity and the sacredness of every individual that is an essential part of Islamic religion. So that's an example of public consequence of religious conviction, and it isn't secular just because it's good. Lots of people think that Islam is, by definition, to be suspect, and when behavior is bad, then we're readily able to label it religious, but when it's good, we call it secular. No, it's not quite that clear. Your call for a more subtle interplay between the secular and the sacred is proper, I think, and we'd be better off if we had a much more astute and informed education about religion in American public life today.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, James Carroll.
Ian, it's always a pleasure. I wish you well.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with James Carroll, who is the author of Jerusalem, Jerusalem, The Ancient City That Ignited the Modern World. He's also a distinguished scholar in residence at Suffolk University. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Sister Anne Kendrick.